Good morning,
once again.
So, with our reading in mind, the gospel reading, it's actually very common for even modern people like us to take a huge story and funnel it into a very small number of words. And to use like an example from like media or from our culture, if you were about to go do something really difficult and I said, well, may the force be with you, you'll know exactly what I mean. And by that saying, that short little phrase, I have funneled a multi-billion dollar media empire into what essentially says, good luck. And in the same way, if, I don't know, I'm eating potato chips, which I try to avoid but can't, and somebody, it'd probably be Bob, by the way, and somebody came and started taking some of those chips, if I were to say, hey, no taxation without representation, you know that I'm like funneling the early history of the United States into basically saying, please stop taking my chips. In the same way, as Matthew is giving the words of the prophet, you know, behold, he comes riding on a donkey, a colt, full of a donkey, you know, so on and so forth. Matthew, first off, is conflating or combining two different prophets, Isaiah and Zechariah. And he does this a lot, and he offers no explanation why, and it's been driving Bible readers really crazy for about 2,000 years. But he does it anyway. But he's not just doing that. He is saying this points to this moment as Jesus is entering Jerusalem for the last time. But he is also drawing a line or making a link or really funneling a very large story from Israel's deep past into this moment. And to understand the full impact, we have to kind of know what that story is. And it comes from the later parts of the life of the great King David. King David, who was originally described as a man after God's own heart, anointed king after the previous king Saul was a total failure. And for the first half-ish of King David's life, he really lived up to that. He was a really quality leader. He cared about the people who were under him. He loved God with all his heart. He danced before God with all his might, as the writer says. And then something happens somewhere in the middle, and he makes some, shall we say, deeply regrettable choices. And in the fallout of those choices, and he deserved far worse than what he got, his family ended up falling apart. And as a result, one of his sons, Absalom, actually staged a successful coup against David's regime. He got, Absalom was able to get enough people behind him, and he was able to take over Jerusalem, oust the king, and essentially take his father's place. And when he did that, he did awful things. I will leave that to the reader to figure out, but you've been warned, it's really bad. And so the rest of that story is how David regains his throne. Now remember, at this point, David is older. He's made some serious mistakes. He's not the young, spry, faithful man that he used to be. Instead, he's more of the broken, filled with at least some regret, knowing he's made some serious mistakes kind of guy. He's less effective as a leader as a result. Now, David has a captain of sorts. His name is Joab, and who is still loyal to David. And after David has spent some time in exile, he and Joab are able to muster a what essentially amounts to an army to retake Jerusalem and reclaim the throne. And I guess because David's old, or maybe he's tired or lazy, that's up for a long discussion. But David does not go to battle. Joab goes in his place. And as Joab is getting ready, he says, "Whatever happens, please spare my son Absalom." Which is insane, in a way, considering Absalom does not deserve to live. Like, I'm pretty iffy. I have very deeply mixed feelings about things like the death penalty. But if anyone deserves it, it's Absalom. Anyway, yeah. So David says, "Just spare my son." So in spite of all of his mistakes, David's heart seems to soften. And the battle is met, and David's forces prevail. So as David is waiting for his messengers, one in particular comes and he says, "The victory is yours," which essentially amounts to, "You are king again." You would think this is good news, but the first words out of David's mouth are, "How's my son?" Which tells you at least something. Now the messenger knows, and David does not, that his son Absalom was essentially entangled in a tree. It's as he was riding a horse, getting away when he realizes things were not going to go his way. And he was essentially caught. He should have been treated in modern terms as a prisoner of war or something like that. Joab, David's right-hand man, kills him, murders him essentially. At this point, it is murder. The messenger knows that. And when David says, "How is my son?" He's like, this is kind of my own translation of sorts. He's like, "Hey, you're king again." It's like, you're not answering the question. Now, eventually, a second messenger comes and David learns the fate of Absalom. And he mourns publicly, crying deeply, as you would, I guess. I don't know, my son has never staged a successful coup against me, but so I'm not really sure how to feel about that, but let's not test that, by the way. Nevertheless, David weeps openly, and his captain Joab scolds him for it. Now, he doesn't really know that it was Joab's hand that killed his son, murdered his son, I should say. But nevertheless, after all of these horrendous, heinous things that have happened within David's family, he is able to die a peaceful death. And on his deathbed, and I know at least one movie from a while ago, I think it was Richard Gere, has him, you know, in his dying words saying, "Be true to yourself," or some nonsense like that. But what David actually says on his deathbed is, "Hey, these people know where the bodies are buried. You should probably them. And Joab especially, he is a dangerous, violent man. You know what to do." And then he dies. That's not what we would call a very forgiving end. And Joab is, when he knows that Solomon, David's son's cronies, are coming, he rushes into the tabernacle of God, clings to the horn of the altar, basically claiming sanctuary, and he would not let go, and he is killed on that spot. Things fall apart. Now, all of that is fun to say that there is a moment when, in 2 Samuel 19, numbers are hard, you'll figure it out. I'm just drawing a blank. There is a celebrated moment when David returns to Jerusalem in peace. And it seems clear to Bible scholars and the like, the people who kind of know these things, that both Isaiah and Zechariah are drawing on this memory. And it is a memory, because by the time of Jesus, this happened about 1,000 years ago, literally. This memory of the rightful king returning to the holy city. And as Matthew is writing this, he can assume that his readers and hearers know the story of Israel's deep past. They know the stories of intense violence and heartbreak, of people generally behaving poorly, to put it very mildly, as well as a sense of the king is in the city, everything's going to be okay. Except, and I would suspect very strongly, that Matthew anticipates a contrast to be discovered. Because as Jesus is entering Jerusalem, he of course comes in peace. He has in fact shed no blood. In fact, his career is marked as one who advocates for nonviolent resistance. Because when Jesus was maybe early teen, 12 or 13 years old, he would have seen what happens when violence challenges violence. There was an uprising in the region where he grew up against Rome. And for their trouble, Rome crushed them and crucified about 2,000 men. That's going to leave a mark on your memory. And while violence can be used to kind of contain and sort of push evil into a particular corner, violence can't cure violence. That's just not how human history has worked. I'm not saying there are not times where it's... I'm not saying it's never justified. We'll just put it like that. But it's never going to solve the core problem, because the core problem is in here. But anyway, as Jesus now is entering the city, he's hailed as this king, but he's not a conqueror. He's not like King David. People have not died so that he can walk or ride peacefully into the holy city. And we're meant to, I think, sit with that difference, because that difference is going to really matter within about a week. Now, at the same time, Jesus coming into the city, the holy city of Jerusalem, is not a sigh of relief like it would have been for the great King David. Because Jesus is walking into a city that is slowly rotting from the inside out. There has started about 15 to 20 years at the least, previous to this moment, there had started a cycle of debt, of people who were really, really wealthy taking advantage of those who had less, beginning a purposeful foreclosure crisis so that the rich can get richer and the poor can just sort of do whatever they're going to do and suffer. And so there's this growing public debt amongst most everybody, while the very top 2% or 1% become really wealthy. There's a growing sense of violence as the region starts to destabilize. Partially as a result of that, there are some other things going on. We're not going to go there today. But you can kind of feel it by this point. And over the next week, the final week of Jesus' life, he's going to point all of this out. And not only that, but he's going to stake his reputation as a prophet on the fact that within a generation, war is coming. And the roots or the seeds of that war have already been sown. And even worse, the core bad actors of this growing crisis are the religious elite, the religious authorities. Essentially the top level of priests of the temple. And so Jesus is then going to also make this wild claim that the temple itself is not going to survive this. So to recap, Matthew quotes a prophet, or the two prophets. And in that quote, he funnels in a very dark time for Israel's history when there's really no clear hero, but the best of the possible outcomes came about as David returned to the holy city and his throne. And people have been waiting for a reenactment of that moment, but for that moment to be rooted in real peace. And all of that complicated story gets funneled into Jesus as he is riding into Jerusalem, truly at peace and truly meaning peace. And yet the city he's riding into is starting to decay because of inescapable debt and a growing sense of destabilization and violence. Now, there's two things we just need to observe to get to where we're going. First off, if you think your family is really messed up, you're not alone. Because look at David's family. Wow. And secondly, it's funny how stories from the ancient world have no parallel to the modern world, right? Anyway, in other words, Jesus is reenacting or reinventing a moment that was deeply unsettling, complicated, and messy. Only the way he does it is truly as a messenger of peace. And he makes his way into a city that is decaying from the inside, deeply messy. There really are very few heroes. And it's the people who should have known better that are at the forefront of that rot and decay. And so as the rest of Jesus' life plays out, all, 7 days or so, we are forced to ask, how is what Jesus about to do and then does an antidote to the mess that he's walking into? How is what Jesus is about to offer and accomplish an answer to the mess of the human lives that he is about to interact with? And that's really the question at the front of Holy Week, which begins today. How do we go through the week to Holy Thursday or Maundy Thursday when Jesus has one final meal with his disciples and drops the bomb that is, my body is about to be broken, my blood is about to be spilled for you, only to be betrayed, arrested, beaten, tortured, shamed, and killed by exposure in the worst possible way at that time. Only to have, at the start, a bunch of scared men hiding in a room, getting visited by a couple of women that they know and love very much, saying, there's more to this story. Something just happened, and then Peter and John go running. And for starters, it's natural and normal to take the mess that sometimes we experience in our lives, or maybe more personally, the mess within my own heart and yours, and the messes that we tend to create ourselves, and to take faith in Jesus and flatten it out and say, well, whatever Jesus did, it's an escape from what's wrong within me. And that goes wrong in so many different ways. Because either we can just pretend that there aren't any problems, we can pretend that there's nothing wrong with me, or I have no culpability in this mess because of my faith, whatever that means. Or we can go the extreme opposite end and say, this is too much of a mess. One prophet from Nazareth, the backwoods part of a backwoods area called Galilee, like there's nothing that he can do that's going to make this better. And then you fall into despair. Both of those are options. And neither of those are what Jesus actually does. Have you ever been in a situation where you could tell that things are about to get really messy. They're not yet, but they're about to. It's kind of a kind of a crass illustration. It's not too bad, so don't come at me, but or do whatever. But I remember a couple of times, especially when I was younger, kind of early mid-20s, of being at like a being at a party or being at a gathering of friends or colleagues or whatever, and you know, libations are flowing, and you realize, oh, this is about to fall apart. This is about to get really bad. I'm out. I'm dipping. This isn't worth my time. Usually, that's the wise thing to do. Because things are coming and it's going to be bad. And for the record, every time I've done that, I've been 100% correct. I'm not meaning to brag, but I can tell when a party is about to go south. Jesus does the opposite of that. Jesus, he does the opposite. He knows the rot and decay that is in the holy city, because he knows the rot and decay that are in the hearts of human beings. And rather than taking the route either of despair, saying, that's just going to go nuts, that's just going to fall apart, it's going to all be destroyed, I'm out of here. Or rather than saying, you know what, my faith has elevated me above humanity, therefore we're going to go and form a commune out in the desert or something like that. Both were options at that time. Jesus says, no. I want to be in the middle of the mess. And if it's true that Jesus wants to be in the middle of the mess that is Jerusalem at that time, then it follows that Jesus wants to be in the middle of the mess that is my own heart and life. And the same is true for you. Holy Week is not about escape. It's about engagement. It's a week where we remember when Jesus entered directly into the worst that humanity has to offer, including the worst of what I have to offer and what you have to offer. And rather than fighting it with violence, which is just fighting fire with fire, which just guarantees that everything is going to burn, he allows it to exhaust itself onto him. And it costs him his life. The only blood shed is his own. And he did it willingly, without a fight. Only to transform the way history works. As we enter into Holy Week, as we receive the sacrament today, and then we remember on Thursday when Jesus gave his body and his blood for the first time, and I would invite you to those services, noon and 7 o'clock, we remember that the way of Jesus is about presence. It's about self-sacrifice instead of violence. We will then go to Good Friday, which it's a long history of the English language. It originally was God's Friday. There's nothing good about it, to be perfectly honest. And I would highly recommend those services, noon and 7 o'clock, especially the 7 o'clock because it's dark, where we reenact and remember the service of darkness, or we reenact in the service of darkness the dark things that happened that day. It is my favorite service every year, where we are reminded that it cost Jesus everything to save ourselves from ourselves. And then on Saturday, as Jesus is lying in his grave in memory, we do nothing. We wait. And then Sunday, resurrection burritos. And every culture has celebrated Resurrection Sunday in different ways. We do it the New Mexican way. And yeah, that's funny, but I'm also being serious. Because why wouldn't we use that as an opportunity to celebrate in any way we can that the messes of our lives, the messes of the world around us, especially at a time when it feels like the world's just on fire, to say those stories, the stories within my own heart and those really dark, unfortunate parts, the human in the worst sense of me parts, none of that defines me anymore. Because rather than running away, Jesus engaged in the darkness. He engaged with the darkness, and rather than fighting it, he let it think it won. And then he transformed the worst of human mortality into a story of victory. And it all begins today with people waving branches, reminiscing about a very complicated time, hoping that God is about to move. And then he did. Amen. As you are able, please rise.